All right. Well, welcome and welcome back to Unapologetically Black Unicorns. And here we are again with another episode with a fantabulous, magnificent, monumental, I'm going to call, you know what? I have a word for you, Sam. Goat. You're the goat. You are like literally like the goat of all time here when we're talking about housing, homelessness, and housing first. So, you know, I don't do introductions. So can you introduce yourself to our audience?
Thank you, Karis. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Sam Tsimbaris. I'm a clinical community psychologist. What Karis is referring to is that I'm often known as the guy who invented housing first, because we started doing it in New York back in the early 90s. It wasn't a thing then, and it's become something of a national and international intervention to help people, especially people with mental health and addiction problems, out of homelessness. So that's been most of my work, and that's what I do.
Awesome. And I think this is such a great time to have this conversation. Well, it's always a good time to have this conversation, but because housing and homelessness is on everybody's mind, we're seeing it across the country, especially at the intersection of quote unquote serious mental illness or mental illness and substance use disorders. We're seeing legislators, you know, elected officials, they're focusing on this area, which is a good thing. And we hear the term supported housing and or housing first. And a lot of times people are using those terms interchangeably. So since you are the quote unquote founder of Housing First, we will give you that title. What exactly is Housing First? How do we know Housing First when we see it or hear it? What is it?
Well, Housing First is really about three things. It's about housing. It's about support services. And it's about recovery. One of the ways that it's most frequently understood is that people think that Housing First is about housing. But I actually think of it as Housing First is about people, because it is fundamentally a person-centered program. And this is where it differs from the way that homelessness, mental illness, and addiction are always spoken about, as if these things are all of the same type of thing, and there's like one solution for them. Oh, let's, you know, house them, let's arrest them, let's make them go to treatment. But we don't think of it like that. We think of people experiencing homelessness, people who have mental health problems, people who have addiction problems, but our focus is the person. And the way that we address these multiple needs is by working directly with the person so that they tell us the sequence and the intensity with which they want their problems addressed. This is actually how Housing First got started. We didn't have any agenda about what we were going to do first. The whole industry in homelessness is treatment, sobriety, then housing eventually, if at all. And that's still the industry. But we did invent this other approach, which is called Housing First. And it's mostly known as you give the housing first and then the treatment. But I want to tell you why we do it this way. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't our idea. It was the person on the street when we went to them and said, I see you're in a lot of trouble here, you know, and what's the best way for us to help you? And the person would say, well, isn't that obvious? You know, I want to get off the street. I want to get out of this town. I need a place to live. Like, oh, okay. Well, yeah, of course that makes sense. And then we would try and go to these permanent supportive housing programs, all these programs that have housing and services, but they also have a lot of rules about who gets in and how. And the people we were working with did not want treatment. They didn't want to get clean and sober to get into housing. They just wanted a place to live first. Mm. There was virtually no organization that was doing work like that. So we had to actually create an organization. It's called Pathways to Housing. And we named it that in particular because we didn't want any treatment associated words associated to the organization, because we were going to be looking for housing in the community. People did not want to live in buildings where everybody had been homeless and was now in recovery. They wanted to live in a ordinary apartment in the community where they lived before, you know, like housing where you and I live, just a regular place, decent and affordable. So we began to, we got a grant for supported housing. Supported housing grants come with rent money and with case management money. So it's a program designed to listen to people. 99% of the people who are homeless want housing first, not us mandating housing first, they choosing housing first. It's a big difference, you know?
Yes.
The Housing First program, as it's gotten to be called, is all about client choice. Mm-hmm. So there's no contradiction, you know, it's not necessarily always a harm reduction program. It's only a harm reduction program if the person is struggling with addiction and, you know, just doing the best we can, you know, they're doing the best they can, we're doing the best we can with them to help them manage the apartment and save some money so that they can continue to pay the rent and not be evicted, you know, because of the right. substance use.
Right.
I would say Housing First is essentially a no discharge program. We very, very hard to get rid of us, you know, because we're committed to you. We're going to help you. And we know there's nowhere else to go except the street. So, okay, they fire, you know, you fire us today. We'll be back tomorrow. And like, you know, can we revisit this question? You really, you know,
you're
did
relentless.
You really mean it? Did you really mean it? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
We get, you know, and people actually, you know what's amazing? People do better in the second apartment than they do in the first. Like the success rate in the first apartment is about 60-65%. And then, you know, they lose something and then they go back to the second one. The success rate on the second ones is 85%. Like people learn from the mistakes of the first one and they hold on to the second one better. So when I'm telling you that the housing retention rate is 80 or 90%, it's not like a one-shot deal. It's like we have to work hard to get to that. You know, we have to stay with people and rehouse them once, twice.
Yeah.
But we give people chances, you know, until they figure it out.
So there's so much I want to unpack here. The first thing I want to say is snaps, claps, thumbs up to the whole nine yards of it. That's my way of saying yay, yay, yay. And also the fact that this is so not just people-centered, but it's like how humans work.
Right.
So let me ask you something, because you also said something about the voluntariness, the voluntary nature, right? Of this is a person's choice. You're meeting people where they are. And if that's kind of where they are, you work with them where they are and help them get to where they want to eventually go. So what happens if somebody, for example, is on conservatorship and the conservator says, no, they need to be in a far more structured environment that is more ordered, kind of like sequentially ordered.
Right.
So are there people who are under conservatorship or guardianship where the conservator or guardianship says, oh, yeah, this is great? I mean,
yeah.
And how does that work if that's the case?
No. It's you advocate on both sides. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if someone has gotten themselves into a conservatorship, but that doesn't mean that they have to live in a locked up unit. You know, with the right supports, they can live up in the community if they're able to cook a meal for themselves and like that. They need help maybe staying on medication. Okay, well, then that team is making daily visits, making sure they're taking their medication. The goal is always to have the person live in a place that is most satisfying to them. To me, you know, if somebody wants to live in a board and care, that's where they're happy, I'm good with that. You know, I mean, it's not my choice. I think they could do better, but like if that's their choice, I support that.
Mm-hmm.
Most people choose a place of their own. That's why the program looks mostly like that. And in that case, you have to make a strong argument to the conservator that, you know, this apartment, even though it looks independent, this person's getting three visits a day, you know, because of the mandate. They're just like in a board and care, except it looks different. So you give them a chance and let's see how we do. And, you know, we can revisit it as frequently as possible. So we're strong advocates on the least restrictive setting closest to client choice.
Wow.
The other way we do it, though, is also a bit more challenging in a way, because there are two program requirements in Housing First. It's all client driven, but you have to do two things. You have to meet the terms and conditions of a standard lease like everybody else in that building, which means, you know, no noise late at night, you know, no traffic, no dealing, no all that, you know, all that stuff that we all have to do to be in the community. You have to do that. Mm-hmm. And you pay 30% of your income, whatever your income is. If it's zero, it's zero until we get you benefits. But you pay 30% of your income towards the rent. That's all part of the lease, okay? Mm-hmm. Second requirement is there are mandatory home visits. You must let us come and see you. We need to see you're okay, and we need to see the apartment's okay. I would say this thing, the mandatory visit, is one of the most frequently misunderstood things about Housing First, because it's so emphasizing choice about everything. But this home visit is not a choice. It's not ethically responsible to put someone who is actively symptomatic and using an apartment and not visit them. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and I'm not saying I'm visiting you to give you medication or to, you know, take a drug test. I'm just visiting you to make sure you're okay. Mm-hmm. And that's understood up front. And that's a mandatory thing. But here's the thing. It's not mandatory for the tenant. You know, it's mandatory that the staff have to figure out how to make the visit. That's what the job of the clinical team is, to create a relationship where the person experiences them as loving, caring, and then the person is ready to open the door and see them. Yeah. So even though the visit is mandatory, you want to create the conditions where mandatory is a condition like, you know, like when you have to go to the lawyer to figure out how to get divorced, you know, it's not, like mostly you want to be in a happy relationship, but there is that sort of bottom line, like we're coming, you know. Yeah. Housing First, it's like, for this population, low caseload ratio, interdisciplinary team, people living in housing and their choice typically means apartments in the community. It is permanent, it is supportive, but it has a philosophy that is completely client-driven, you know, harm reduction, trauma-informed. The philosophy, I would say, is the third leg of this, of the definition of Housing First. There's the housing, which is tenant-based vouchers, predominantly living in the community, the services offsite, and a philosophy like the philosophy we're talking about. Permanent supportive housing could be anything. Could be a single site building with a case manager on site. They could have all kinds of program rules. They often do. It's often a concentration of people with the same issues. That's how I think of permanent supportive housing. So I would say that Housing First is a subset of a housing type, you know, that is permanent and supportive, but has its own architecture as a program and philosophy. And it's not rapid rehousing, because rapid rehousing is like rent money for a short time. It's not permanent. And the case management ratios, even if they have case management, are quite high. So people say, oh, you're putting someone in housing right away. Well, that's true, but, you know, that's only like 4 points out of 40, you know, the checklist for Housing First has 40 points, and some programs, you know, have 3, 5, 10, even 20 of them. But now we're talking about program fidelity. Mm-hmm. And if you have high program fidelity, you're scoring 35 out of 40, not 20. And if you're scoring 35 out of 20, you're going to have an 80 or 90% housing retention rate. Because if you're only scoring 20 out of 40, your housing retention rate is going to be at 50 or 60%.
Wow. Wow.
Because you have too many caseload, labor ratios, or however else you're failing on the program.
Yeah. Are there, out of those 40 points, are there any that are a shall have versus a out of the 40?
Yeah. I don't think they're all the same value. I think the choice in housing, the separation of housing and services, the harm reduction, you know, the no discharge policy. There are some core elements, I would say, that really are not negotiable.
I see. Okay. Very interesting. So You've talked a little bit about, well, let's talk a little bit about the research.
Well, the research we had to do because nobody believed this thing was working. I can describe it. I can tell you what it was, but that's like people said, no way. Like you're taking the easiest people. It's like actually the opposite was true. We were taking people no one else would take. But because we needed to kind of demonstrate it, we got a grant from SAMHSA, and we had our first randomized controlled trial. It was a randomized controlled trial, 225 people on the streets of New York, and they were essentially there were no differences in the clinical or demographics of this population, so they were the same people, not the easiest people, they were the same. And then they went to either the step of shelter, transitional, and eventually permanent, for those that got there, to right into housing, the housing first thing, from the street into housing and then supports. And after 2 years, our housing retention rate in housing first was about 84%. And for the step-by-step programs, it was about 35%. So it was not a small difference. It was like huge,
Yeah, night and day.
And we published it in the American Journal of Public Health and then other studies. I mean, since that study, the Canadian government did a 5-city randomized controlled trial. Vancouver, Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal, and Moncton, New Brunswick came up with essentially the same results for the 2,000 people in their study. There was another randomized controlled trial in France, same results. So this housing first thing is being used in a lot of different countries in a lot of different contexts, but when it's being done well, and to fidelity, the results are the same in all of these different contexts.
So, what is our problem in the United States? I'm just, I don't really, I hate to say
Well,
it that
no,
way.
well, no, but it's capitalism, basically. I mean, just like we don't like these other countries start out with fewer homeless people. They have a national health plan. Every one of the other countries that I have visited, I haven't visited the Global South very much. They don't have social housing, but everyone, like in the European, Australia, New Zealand, all of that, Canada, everybody has social housing. Just like we used to have public housing. We, since 1980, went out of the public housing business, never really went back to it in any scale. And, we have a tremendous housing shortage, which is very good for the real estate market, not for us renters, but for the people making money on real estate. Nobody wants public housing back. No one is talking about it, not Democrats, not Republicans, because it would drive down the market value of housing if you suddenly started to put a lot of affordable housing on the market. And then you have zoning laws. It's sort of a market-driven catastrophe that is benefiting a lot of people and hurting an increasing number, but not big enough to create the revolution yet.
Yeah, thank you for talking about the decimation of our public housing system. I actually do talk about that. I sort of bumped into that during when Care Court was just a piece of legislation, and there are other things that followed. I was really trying to understand what problem are we trying to solve, and ultimately the problem is about homelessness, and
It's about
right,
housing, right?
it's about housing. So
Right,
the
because we had
rhetoric.
mental illness and addiction for many, many years. It's like homelessness is just about it's a housing problem.
And then the rhetoric, especially like in California with Proposition 1 around, treatment not tents, which sort of seems to say that everybody in a tent or everybody who's unhoused needs some kind of treatment,
Right, exactly.
so then we have to unpack, well, what is the issue with housing and homelessness? And then of course there's affordability, but what did happen to our public housing? Because a lot of the other rhetoric was there are no treatment beds and there are no treatment beds because of deinstitutionalization. And that's when I kind of dug a little bit deeper to figure out, well, when did deinstitutionalization happen and what else was happening in the social construct of the United States? And HUD was being decimated shortly after. So these things were happening kind of all at the same time. Our safety net was sort of just knocked out, and that impacted people who, were on Social Security or on disability or,
Right.
who are poor. And then, you know, there's also racism and zoning and housing that was
Yes,
going on in the 60s. So we have all of these things that are foundationally driving still what we're experiencing today. Oh, that was the 60s, that was the 70s. Yeah, but it was never right sized.
Well, we didn't have homelessness like this till the 80s.
Yeah.
And I think that actually my sense of history is that the deinstitutionalization started much earlier. When Thorazine was discovered, they started letting people out because you could have a monthly injection. But people were living somewhere, even with the, you know, little tiny SSI benefit, there was still affordable housing, you know, SRO rooms or this. And then in the 80s, with the disappearance of public housing and the real estate beginning to escalate, suddenly, you know, your SSI check was never going to get you a room or an apartment or anything else. So then we began to see homelessness big time. And of course, the people falling out first were people who had mental illness because they were the ones on fixed income and there was no way in. And then people began to equate the homelessness with the mental illness as if that was the cause.
Exactly. And, you know, some people believe that they are in supported housing first practice kind of a building or where they live. And then they're kicked out because they came home at 10 o'clock at night because the curfew was 9 o'clock at night or something.
Right.
Or there's some other rule that they broke. And again, it wasn't a rule about that's in the lease
the
that
lease,
we would
right.
all see in a lease. Like
right.
my lease does not say that I have to be in at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. My lease
right.
does say something about noise.
Yeah.
Does say, right. So those things I have to be, but this is about other kind of rules that are
program rules.
Right. So what should somebody who is looking to get into a housing program, what kind of questions maybe should they have, like the top three, four questions about, is this housing first, so that they're aware of it is or it isn't? They can make up their mind if they want to do it one way or the other.
Right. Well, I mean, I would say that you want to find out exactly what you said, like other rules besides what's on the standard lease in order for me to be able to get into this program. What other rules are there? Even if it's a housing first program, someone should tell you, well, you're going to get a home visit by a case manager. You know, what about, can I keep my beer in the fridge or do I have to hide it under the couch when you come over? You know, like, what about that? You know, that's something you'd want to know. You know, is it a harm reduction program? And do you have, you know, a choice about how you live your, you know, no, I'm not talking about drinking in the hallway or the lobby. I'm talking about your apartment.
Yes.
You know, do I have to hide my beer when you come over?
Okay.
And what about guests? You know, what's the policy on guests? Can I have people over? They have to leave at 9 o'clock. Can I have, you know, if I'm in a relationship with someone, can they stay over? You know, like, what about that? And then what support is there? And what are the requirements for me to participate? You know, do I have to maintain sobriety? Do I have to be medication compliant? Or could I just use support to guide my own treatment?
Yeah. Ben, wow. Those are great. I'm going to ask now, you just triggered another question. But before I get to that other question, what are some things that advocates can be doing to help advance more use of housing first models? I'm getting a sense it's not super popular in the United States, but I see it popular every place else. But you've said why.
Yeah.
What more could advocates be doing when we're hearing, oh, we want to do supportive housing or we want to do this step down kind of thing? How can we say, well, maybe we get more bang for our buck and also help more people if we were to use a housing first model? I mean, what
we would, because we would be building, we should be building affordable housing for the so many people who are homeless. And some of those people, not all of them, will need case management support. But this idea of building these permanent supportive housing units, which are twice the price of building a regular apartment, and they're also discriminatory by definition, because everyone in the building can be labeled as like this kind of a person, you know, was formerly homeless or has an issue. You know, it's an Olmstead violation. I don't think people use Olmstead, you know, in the Supreme Court decision that says that people with disabilities should be living in the least restrictive environments in the community with access to culture, family, employment, like the rest of us. Even though there is an Olmstead probably office in every state, and about 15 states are under DOJ, you know, class action settlement suits representing the rights of people with disabilities to get them out of, you know, these congregate settings. So I think we have to be advocating for that. Like, let's advocate for what is normal housing with supports for some people, you know?
Yeah, that's super helpful. And can you say what Olmstead is so people are aware?
Olmstead is a, Olmstead lawsuit was filed in 1995, and the decision was issued by the Supreme Court in 1999, okay? In 1999, U.S. Supreme Court held in Olmstead versus LC and EW that people with disabilities, and that included people with psychiatric disabilities, because this was all about the ADA. This is really an extension of the ADA, physical disabilities extended to psychiatric disabilities, have the right to live in the community with support. You know, in the least restrictive settings. Some people have called it the Brown versus Board of Education for the disability community.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I mean, it's had that much of an impact, you know.
I got to meet Lois, actually.
Oh, you did?
Several times. She's a beautiful artist and just a beautiful young woman.
Actually
passed away a couple years ago. But
that's right, yeah.
She always said, I just want to be happy. I want to be with my friends. I want to have my friends over. It was like the simplest things that we all want, but she was not afforded because she was institutionalized, because she had both developmental disabilities and mental health disabilities. So, you know, we have to really thank her and others for the fight so that people could have that right to live in community of their choice with the supports needed.
And Sue Jameson from Atlanta Legal Aid for taking the case. You know?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I was thinking too, and I heard this, and I need to circle back to the person, their housing, like supported, maybe it's more supported, I'm guessing it's unsupported housing, in which, or some version of supported housing for people with substance use disorders, where they are not allowed to take psychiatric medication. So if they have a co-occurring condition, that they're not permitted to take psychiatric meds. And I know that's a thing in the substance use community. When
Well, it's a thing, like leeches were a thing for, you know, curing blood-borne diseases. You know, it's like, it's so inconsistent with like good integrated health practice that it's just, it's punitive, really.
All right. I think that's something I'll have to kind of dig a little bit deeper into, because we certainly don't want people, again, to be discriminated against because they have a co-occurring condition.
Yeah, no, it's terrible that they won't give people medication for their anxiety or depression or, you know, whatever it is that they need it for. But it's also true, you know, I mean, if you're going to run these Housing First programs, you have to have a staff that is a harm reduction staff. And the psychiatrist, for example, in a Housing First program is always dealing with people with co-occurring. It's usually the other way around. People are using all kinds of drugs and they want their medication that helps them to calm down. And the psychiatrist has to decide, you know, is it worth, it's not a really good mix for someone using to also have psychoactive medication. But on the other hand, why have the person suffer? And so you minimize the dosage, you explain to the person what the risks are, because they're going to go out and get it on the street anyway.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, treat the person with dignity, explain what it is. It's in their hands. It's their life. I mean, you do the best you can. And there is a risk associated to it that most medical professionals are not going to be willing to take. And that's not going to be somebody who's going to be working in your Housing First program. You know, you have to have not only the knowledge and the skill, but you have to have the value set that allows the person the dignity of learning by their mistakes.
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that. And I think that's what makes, that really is, whether it's Housing First or other programs that are very, you know, person-centered, person-driven, recovery-oriented, with a lot of autonomy and self-determination. It makes a difference when that is a value set that drives the culture of the work that's being done. So the workforce has to match that value set to work within that culture. And I've seen it over and over and over again where, you know, people have had to say, well, I don't believe in that. And they choose to, I can't work at this particular organization.
Can't work it. That's right.
Self-select.
That's right.
And/or
That's right.
Don't work out and they get fired. But for the most
That's
part,
right.
people self-select because they realize that this is not within my value set.
That's
You know,
right.
no shame. But it is very hard to carry out that work because it's culture driven and you've defined the culture, you know, through those values and practices. So
And I think people are used to hearing, oh, you have a drug problem. Well, this is a mental health program. You can't come here. Or, oh, you have a mental health issue. This is a drug treatment program. You know, in the Housing First program, we're expecting complexity. We're expecting health problems, swollen feet, addiction, mental. You have all these things. You are in the right place. This is the place for you. Not only not disqualifying people for complexity, but welcoming the complexity.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I mean, I always say people are complex. If you want it easy, this is seriously not the field. for you. That people are complex and they're coming with a myriad of issues and a myriad of other things around them that are imposed on them that I think exacerbate the complexity.
Right.
And so how do we understand all of that? So I'm like all excited to figure out like, okay, you know, what am I going to do now? And how am I going to continue to advocate? I mean, I've been saying housing first. This is why I wanted to have the conversation and, you know, consider you an unapologetically Black unicorn because you're unapologetic about this stuff, have been for years, but it's because sometimes we say the word, but we don't know what is it really? We think we kind of know, but you've just unpacked it. And, you know, I feel so much better educated and equipped to be able to have a better conversation about housing first and the need for it. This is the part where we do our wisdom dropping. Is there any piece of wisdom or something that we didn't cover that you want to leave our listeners with before we wrap up?
No, I really enjoyed our conversation very much. And we got to some good places, you know, with it in terms of the fundamentals. And I guess if we, you know, what is the takeaway message? One message, what is Housing First? It's all about people.
Full stop. I don't have any more to say. Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much,
Thank
Sam.
Thank you, Cass. It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, yes. Thank you for joining me on Unapologetically Black Unicorns. And to our listeners, you know, my producer makes me say this. And okay, producer, I'm going to say it. Like, comment, subscribe. I sound like a content creator. But those things are kind of important. But really the most important thing, the most important thing is to please share the podcast. There are other people who could benefit from hearing the messages and the information shared by Sam. And we really want to get the word out there. So please make sure to share. And until next week, I will see you all on Unapologetically Black Unicorns.